Washington DC မြို့တော်ကနေတိုက်ရိုက်ထုတ်လွှင့်ပေးနေပါတယ်ရှင်
各位观众朋友大家好，欢迎收看美国观察，我是林森。美国总统拜登正在考虑联邦汽油免税期，并且限制对中国进口商品的部分关税。6月20号是世界难民日，拜登总统发表声明，赞扬人道救援工作者的努力。美国人庆祝最新的联邦假日六月节，纪念黑奴获得自由。以上主要内容，今天的节目带您关注。好，新闻头条我们关注的是拜登总统将在本周六出访德国与西班牙，并且参加七国集团与北约峰会。另一方面，6月20号是世界难民日，拜登总统发表声明，赞扬人道救援工作者的努力。拜登总统还特别提到了阿富汗与乌克兰难民。详细情况，来看美国之音白宫记者黄亚毅的报道。
拜登总统在特拉华州度过解放黑奴纪念日 Juneteenth 的这个长周末假期。那么在星期一的上午呢，在海滩上随团的记者就询问了拜登总统在预计本周要出访欧洲的行程当中是否可能会顺道访问乌克兰。对此呢，拜登总统表示要看情况，也就是看说呢是否会给乌克兰造成困难，并且让他们分心。
That depends.
On what?
On a lot of things relating to whether or not it causes more difficulty for Ukrainians, whether it distracts from what's going on, but I've been meeting with Zelensky, and I've talked with him almost, well, at least 3-4 times a week, but I'll be heading, I'm going into Germany, then I'm going to Spain, then I'm going to Israel, then I'm going into Saudi Arabia for a larger meeting of the community there, and then I'll be coming home, probably, directly.
So not going to Ukraine on the trip?
Well, on this trip.
他拜登总统的行程呢，预计是本周六6月25号到30号出访德国与西班牙，参加 G7 以及北约的峰会，然后在7月的13号到16号访问以色列以及沙特阿拉伯。此外呢，6月20号也是世界难民日，拜登总统也透过白宫发出了声明，表示许多的难民是出自于战乱、天灾、宗教迫害、经济贫困，或如像女性以及 LGBTQ+ 族群受到了歧视或威胁，美国正在尽力的推进长期的安置以及解决方案。他并且也赞扬人道救援工作者的努力。拜登也特别提到阿富汗以及乌克兰的难民。不过根据美国移民局的数据，目前申请庇护的阿富汗难民只有不到10%获得批准。而根据移民局资料呢，从2021年7月美国撤军以来，收到了超过46000名阿富汗人申请庇护的案件，当中目前已经完全处理了5000件，而其中有超过90%，也就是有4246件被驳回，只有297件获得批准。而美国去年在撤军的时候呢，已经撤离了，并且在其他国家安置了一部分的阿富汗人。而这4万多的案件呢，是当初没有来得及抵达喀布尔机场登上撤离专机的阿富汗人。那拜登总统在今天的声明当中也说呢，美国在去年已经欢迎超过8万名的阿富汗人来到美国，那现在呢，也正在为数万名的乌克兰人提供暂时的安全居所。美国之音白宫记者黄亚毅，白宫报道。
与此同时，美国总统拜登6月20日表示，他在考虑暂停联邦汽油税，也就是所谓的汽油税假期。此举可能减轻民众的负担，每加仑汽油可以节约 48.4 美分。目前美国汽油的平均价格已经接近每加仑5美元。
Soon can
we expect a decision?
Well, I hope I have a decision based on the data I'm looking for by the end of the week.
另一方面，美国财政部长耶伦6月19日表示，美国总统拜登除了考虑联邦汽油免税期之外，同时也在考虑审查对华关税政策，限制对中国进口商品的部分关税，以帮助美国人应对国内消费品价格飙升的问题。因为上届政府征收的一些关税没有达到战略目的，会增加消费者的成本。他预计美国经济在未来几个月将会放缓，但是他并不认为衰退是完全不可避免的。 美国国务卿布林肯6月20日通过视讯向三海倡议峰会发表讲话，强调乌克兰战争显示了牢固的交通基础设施的重要性。
Greater energy independence will make member states less vulnerable to the Kremlin's coercion. It will deprive the Russian government of massive resources that's used to help bankroll its attack on the independence of Ukraine, not to mention several other countries in recent years. This will move the region and the world. President Putin's war of choice has highlighted the critical importance of strong transportation infrastructure. The region's roads, rails, and airfields have been used by NATO to move personnel and equipment in order to reinforce the alliance's eastern flank.They've been used to get life-saving humanitarian and security assistance into Ukraine and to get nearly 6 million civilians out of Ukraine, most of whom have found refuge and remarkable generosity in your countries.
美国国家安全顾问沙利文星期六新冠病毒检测结果呈阳性。沙利文原定一个星期以后陪同拜登总统出席七国集团峰会，目前还不清楚阳性检测结果是否会影响沙利文的旅行计划。沙利文与拜登没有密切接触，是无症状感染者，这也是他第一次感染新冠病毒。白宫星期六表示，一周前的6月13日，沙利文在卢森堡与中国最高外交官杨洁篪举行了4.5小时的会晤。中国艺术家艾薇薇的艺术作品《汞》6月20日世界难民日在瑞典斯德哥尔摩国家博物馆前展出。这件12米高的艺术品的形状像一个笼子，门洞是相互扶持的两个人的剪影。作品讲述了难民的故事，以及呼吁一个没有边境的世界。美国人星期日6月19日庆祝最新的联邦假日六月节。这个节日是为了纪念被奴役的黑人在1865年内战结束时获得解放。去年国会通过了六月节全国独立日法案，并由总统拜登签署成为法律之后，全美第二年过这个节假日。一些历史学家相信，提高对六月节的认识将鼓励美国民众就种族关系和奴隶制遗留问题展开积极的对话。首场六月节庆祝活动可以追溯到1866年。目前几乎所有的50个州以及首都华盛顿现在都庆祝六月节，庆祝活动通常会举办音乐节或者是游行。中国中央政府6月19日任命了香港特别行政区第六任行政长官李家超及其政府26名主要官员。今年六月也是香港爆发举世关注的反送中运动3周年。37岁的美籍律师贝奇森过去几年以香港为家，从没有想过自己有一天会因为被遣返而回到美国。贝奇森对美国之音说，他会继续为香港的人发声，即使被控违反国安法他也毫不在意。
You were sentenced to 4 months and 2 weeks for assaulting a police officer and for a common assault in Hong Kong. You have legal background and also decade-long practice. Could you tell us, do you think that was a fair trial? What could be problematic there?
I was charged with general assault on a police officer, which isn't a national security crime. And it's an important point. There's a lot of focus on the national security law, but the large majority of political prisoners in Hong Kong are not under the national security law, and have to be sort of approached and dealt with in a different way. I think if I had been charged under the national security law, I'd still be in prison. There's not much hope for people who have been because of the way that that's set up. I think that up until my first conviction, I somewhat naively thought, and sort of my lawyers, sort of the public, sort of the press, that even with the most, pro-Beijing magistrate, there was no way that they could convict me of this crime. There was video of the incident from beginning to end. There was video of this supposed police officer committing crime after crime after crime. But he still convicted me. And the way that he did that was essentially just making up a series of facts. He described a video that didn't exist. He described testimony that didn't exist. It crossed a line from, simple misinterpretation into serious judicial misconduct. And I think mine was one of the earliest cases where that had happened. Since then, we've seen quite a few. And, you know, I think this is where the distinction between national security law cases and non-NSO cases matter. Under the national security law, it's a very, you know, terrible law. Judges don't really need to make much up in order to convict somebody under the national security law because the law itself is so bad. But under the non-national security law cases, Beijing relies on bad acting judges, judges who don't do their job in good faith, and judges who are willing to commit misconduct in order to convict people under these more, you know, older, more traditional laws like assault on a police officer, public assembly, rioting. And what we're seeing more and more is just this rampant judicial misconduct at the lower levels. So no, I certainly didn't get a fair trial. And I'm not the only one. Whether it's still possible to get a fair trial, there are some judges and magistrates who still seem to be doing their jobs. But what used to be a fairly random assignment system now seems to have been co-opted, and it's no longer random. Any politically tinged cases tend to go to judges who are certain to convict. So it becomes very, very difficult to get a good decision at the lower courts.
And could you also tell us some of your plans next?
One thing that I am doing is I'm appealing my own case up to the Court of Final Appeal. And, you know, I don't think we have a good chance of winning. The purpose of that is really to put it as a test to the Court of Final Appeal. The Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong has done a really good job of putting their head in the sand, pretending that there are no problems in their lower courts, ignoring the fact that a lot of their lower court judges are, you know, committing misconduct left and right. But the Court of Final Appeal itself, it's been very conservative in its decisions, but it hasn't outright broken the law in the way that some of the lower courts have. So my appeal up will be a bit of a challenge to them and essentially say, you know, either do what you're supposed to do and overturn this absurd decision from your lower courts, or don't, and show the world that the Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong no longer cares about rule of law or judicial independence. So the purpose there is really to, you know, try to hold their feet to the fire. That might take a while, but, you know, we'll be persistent on it, and we'll try to force them to make a decision. If they rule in my favor, I don't think they will, but if they rule in my favor, it'll give us an opportunity to hold a lot more people accountable, to hold the police officers and the prosecutors accountable for their misconduct, to hold the magistrate and the judge accountable for their misconduct. If they rule against me, which I think in the current state is far more likely, it'll give us another piece of evidence, and a strong one, I think, since my case is so obvious, that the Court of Final Appeal is no longer adhering to rule of law. And that will give us more ammunition to hopefully persuade some of these foreign judges to resign and to persuade business interests in Hong Kong that the courts are no longer independent.
You were put in the maximum security prison in Hong Kong. How was the situation like? Could you describe the circumstances and life as an inmate there?
I was in Lai Chi Kok first, and then I was in the maximum security Stanley prison. Stanley, I would describe as, you know, and Lai Chi Kok really, the whole prison system I would describe as, you know, worse than your typical Western prison, but better than a prison in China. There is still some semblance of rights. I was in prison first last summer, and last summer, between last summer and my most recent last month imprisonment, there's been drastic changes. You know, there's far less respect for people's rights. There's, you know, in sort of in the name of sort of COVID prevention, all rights were stripped away, essentially, from prisoners this past time. You know, all these things that are enshrined in law that you're supposed to get, daily showers, daily exercise, the right to have contact with your lawyers, the right to have contact with your consulate, all of these things were taken away this past time I was in prison. And, you know, they do this in the name of COVID prevention, but it doesn't really make sense for COVID prevention. The one thing that they could do to prevent COVID, which is to do daily testing, they fake it. They hand people tests and they ensure that, you know, prisoners are given ample opportunity to fake the tests. Like most things in Hong Kong, I think COVID over the past year has been used as an excuse to just keep stripping people's rights away. And that's true in the prisons as well. As for me, I was, you know, generally treated, I think, better than your average prisoner. Part of that is still sort of a lingering racism in the prisons, where foreigners tend to be treated better than locals. Part of that is that I was well connected. I'm a lawyer, I'm a foreigner, I had a U.S. passport, I had 9 lawyers visiting a lot, and I had the ability to make trouble for them if I wanted to. I was kept sort of separate from most things that would, be seen as too problematic.
How involved were you in the Hong Kong's activism circle back then? During the anti-extradition law movement in 2019, what kind of role did you play at that time?
More than people probably think. It's funny, I was in Taiwan for a couple of years, and then I got back to Hong Kong in June 2019, just a few days before the protests started. So I'm pretty sure there's got to be somebody in Beijing who thinks I'm like the CIA puppet master who made it all start or something like that. So I went to that first Wednesday protest in June at the LegCo, and I started taking pictures. Before I knew it, this peaceful protest had police officers running in from every direction, shooting tear gas, beating up people, choking them, hitting them, spraying them. It was an absolute nightmare, and it really was a defining moment for me because I'd never seen anything like it. A peaceful protest, rowdy or not, it was very clear to me watching these police officers that the intent was to drive in there and escalate matters significantly. From that point on, I was as supportive as I could be of the protests, and particularly their calls for investigations into police violence. Once you've seen that, it's hard not to really focus on trying to get some sort of justice for that. And then, of course, going down to protests after that, it became worse and worse and worse. I can't count the number of times I've been tear gassed. I can't count the number of times I've seen, you know, young men and women beaten while they're on the ground. And there's been no consequences at all for these criminal police officers. We support Hong Kongers having democracy. We certainly supported the removal of the extradition bill, but it makes my blood absolutely boil that these criminals who run this government think that it's okay that there are videos after videos of police officers committing serious violent crimes against innocent people and that none of them have been held accountable for it. I supported the protests from quite early on, and my friends would joke that I was going to get arrested one day, and then after I got arrested, everybody joked that, you know, it's just amazing that I got arrested for something that wasn't even a protest. I mean, we were just out shopping, and there was a crime taking place.
You worked as a lawyer in Hong Kong for many years, and then you got arrested because of that. You were put in prison and deported back to the U.S. Have you ever imagine such a twist will happen in your life? Who do you think should be the one to blame?
I certainly never imagined it, but I don't regret it. I mean, I think it, I'm a person of faith, and I think that things happen for a reason. And I think that this was a really important reminder to me of why I became a lawyer. I didn't become a lawyer to help corporations get richer. I became a lawyer to, you know, try to bring a little bit more justice into the world before I die. And this reminded me of that, and it got me out of that sort of path. As for who's to blame, I think what's quite scary about about the Hong Kong situation is there is no one person to blame, right? It's a systemic breakdown, and witnessing it, I think, should make everyone who knows the Hong Kong story really reflect on how easy it is for a powerful authoritarian government to essentially intimidate and manipulate an entire system to break down. Democracy is delicate. Rule of law is delicate. And if you don't treat them carefully and value them, then they can break down very quickly and very easily. And that's what happened in Hong Kong. It wasn't just one person. It was an entire system. It was thousands and thousands of people, public officials, media people, even members of the public who, for one reason or another, felt that the best course of action for them was to abandon their responsibility to the law, to the society, to their friends and family and neighbors in order to roll over for a lawless regime.
For Americans or Westerners who have some connections with the political movement in Hong Kong, do you have some suggestions for them? Is Hong Kong still a safe place for Westerners to live in?
No, I mean, I don't think Hong Kong is safe. The laws are, essentially arbitrarily enforced at this point. Whatever the law says on paper is not how it's going to be enforced. There are, two classes of society, and depending on which class you fall into depends on whether you're subject to the law or not. I think my case, but not only my case, shows that whatever protection foreigners might have had before, it's eroding some. You know, so far with foreigners, the police and the DOJ, they haven't crossed that line into charging foreigners yet under the national security law, but they will. And in the meantime, there are plenty of ways that they can harass us and make our lives difficult. And they do, and they've shown very much a willingness to do that. I think if it wasn't clear to anyone before, it should be clear after the last several months of, purported COVID policies, that it is quite clearly the intention of this government and of Beijing to actually drive foreigners and upper middle class to wealthy Hong Kongers out of the city. I think they want to get rid of whoever is able to leave. They want them to leave, and they want to replace them with people who will be more subservient to their needs.
You were deported from Hong Kong on the short notice. Was there something unfinished in Hong Kong, or is there something that you wish you could make it before you leave?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to stay. It's certainly safer for me to be gone, but I'm stubborn and I wanted to stay. They weren't going to let me. In normal times, they would have at least granted a visitor visa to allow me to stay for a while, wrap up my things, and say goodbye to my partner and my friends. They didn't allow that this time, so they took me straight there. So my partner is still in Hong Kong. My dog is still in Hong Kong. And they're working on getting over here, but it'll take time, I think. All my furniture and stuff is still in Hong Kong, but we'll get that over sometime soon. There was really no opportunity to wrap anything up. I miss my partner very much. My partner's Hong Kong Chinese. And I really hope he'll be here soon. After my partner, my dog, and then, of course, my friends. When you first get to Hong Kong, it's about, big lights and shiny activities and stuff, but pretty quickly it becomes about the people that you care about, your friends and your family. And I miss them all very much. I guess this is terrible, but one of the silver linings is, more and more of my friends are leaving Hong Kong and going to the UK or going to Australia or going to Canada and some even to the US. So hopefully I'll get to see people sooner rather than later. I think we're in a position now where, there's only one way that Hong Kong is going to be returned back to Hong Kongers, and that's the fall of the CCP. And that's something that we'll all continue to work for from here. They can charge me with national security violations for that if they want. I guess I'm not there anymore. But I think that, the Hong Kong movement, human rights movement, is distinct in some ways, but ultimately, whether it's Hong Kong, whether it's Taiwan, whether it's Xinjiang, Tibet, Mongolia, the fates of all of these cultures are now reliant on one very important goal, which is the destruction of the Chinese Communist Party. This could be a really long fight, multi-generationals or not, but I hold out hope, and I would say I even have faith that one day before I die, I'll be able to walk in Hong Kong again.
真相为重，掌握全球脉动，只要点击 VOA Plus， 手指移动，信息即来，追踪政治动向，体验真实生活，世界各地的声音随时随地轻松获取。现在就下载 VOA Plus 应用程序 VOA Plus。
美军在迪克斯堡进行训练，视频中的画面是作为部署到中东的军训的一部分。传统悠久的第182步兵团的成员在这个得天独厚的营地演习，在实弹环境中和压力条件下加强训练。该视频与有关美国军方的特定军事行动无关，仅为展示美军训练的一个最新状态。
182nd Infantry Regiment is considered the oldest unit in the United States Army. We trace our lineage back to 1636, and this unit was present at the Battle of Lexington and Concord for the shot heard around the world, and since then has been present for every major campaign in the United States history, World War I, World War II, straight through to Afghanistan and current day.
Called a squad attack. So you'll have two fire teams firing and maneuvering on multiple different enemy objectives. They'll be using small arms fire, they'll be using pyrotechnics, and they'll be using smoke, and those things are kind of incorporated for signaling and masking movement.
We've done this day and night, so it felt as if it was muscle memory, really. It's sticking to the, or, you know, sticking to the orders and stuff like that, and doing what you told me to do.And focusing, breathing, making sure you're eliminating the objective, things like that. I feel as if it's sort of second nature now after you've done everything.
今天美国观察的全部内容就是这些，感谢您的收看，我们下次节目再见。